The wolves and grizzlies are mostly gone. Thanks to you, Jamie put in. And they starve. I'm not sure it's a good test, Jamie said. If you don't kill the elk, it's not as though the elk will kill you. Caleb drained his cup and set it aside. It's easier to kill an elk than a man, Jamie. But you don't have to do either. Right, I could just embrace being a coward. Caleb met his eye. You're not a coward. Jamie wanted to ask Caleb whether he'd killed Barclay McQueen. But what difference did it make? And there were people Jamie had wanted to kill. That boy who'd been torturing the dog, Mr. Fahey, Barclay. He had it in him, the urge. All right, let's go tomorrow. He didn't sleep well. The whiskey had set the cabin and the sound of the crickets spinning slowly around him, and he lay on Caleb's floor at the center of the sickening swirl and thought yet again about Sarah Fahey's letter. It had arrived in July, long after Marion had come and gone. Dear Jamie, I hope you don't mind that I've written. I got your address from the museum. We parted on imperfect terms, and I feel regret about our conversation. I still believe it is not enough to do nothing, but now that more time has passed, I've come to believe it is unconscionable to persuade people who abhor violence, as I think you do, to commit it. I want no part of such a process, even though I understand this war requires numbers above all else. Which brings me to my purpose in writing. I have heard of an opportunity. All branches of the armed forces are seeking artists to document the war. A family friend who's high up in the Navy told me about it, as of course we know many artists, and I mentioned you. My understanding is that you would complete the necessary training to earn your commission and be sent to combat areas, but would not be expected to fight. There would be risks, of course. But if you want, I would be happy to connect you with the relevant people. I hope you and your sister are well. My brother, Irving, is an officer on a destroyer in the Pacific, and Lewis has joined as a medic. I miss them both horribly. Sarah. Jamie hadn't told Caleb about the letter, or mentioned it when he wrote to Marion, for fear they would tell him this opportunity, as Sarah had put it, was a perfect solution to his dilemma. Nor had he replied to Sarah. He could not disagree with her implication that being a military artist would nominally fulfill his duty, but still he bristled. She didn't think he could hack it. Millions of other men had simply gone off to war, but she thought he needed a special, cushy assignment. On the other hand, the assignment was something he was plainly qualified for, much more than he was to be a grunt. He woke hot and dry-mouthed after only a few hours, his heart racing, the smell of coffee hanging oily in the air. Though night still seemed entrenched, Caleb was moving around, cracking eggs, setting a pan on a burner. They ate in silence. Caleb instructed him to go outside to the pump and scrub with soap, so the elk wouldn't catch their scent so easily. As the darkness faded to indigo, they walked into the woods. For hours, Jamie followed Caleb, a rifle on his back, his head aching and his stomach sour. He didn't ask where they were going. Clouds of blue mist shifted among the trunks and branches. He tried to step where Caleb stepped, to make as little noise as he did. But Caleb seemed to slither like a snake, with barely a rustle, while he clomped along like a cart horse. A stick cracked under his boot. Caleb glanced back. Sorry, Jamie whispered. Caleb held up one arm. Jamie stopped. Caleb seemed to be listening, but Jamie, straining his ears, perceived only faint dripping. And under that, an ambient silence prickling with all the sounds that could not be heard. Growing plants, creeping insects, drifting dust. In the war, he knew, Such a silence would be tense with the possibility of unseen weapons being lifted and aimed. Caleb took a bamboo tube from his belt and blew through it, making a shrill, rising note that ended in a low honk. They waited. In the distance, an elk bugled. Caleb gestured to the left, and they continued on. By a small pond, Caleb pointed to hoof prints and to mud smeared on the trees by wallowing animals. After a while, he stopped again and knelt with his rifle across his knees. Jamie sat on a cushion of pine needles, his back against a tree trunk. There was nothing to see, only mist. Jamie allowed his eyes to droop closed. Sometime later, Caleb shook his shoulder to wake him. A hard knot of bark was digging into his back. Drool slimed his cheek. Caleb pointed into a meadow that had materialized just beyond the trees. Yellow light pierced the patchy fog still hanging low over tall grass. A herd of elk was moving slowly along, grazing. Females with knobby legs and mulish ears, the bull at the back watchful, the dark fur at his neck thick and shaggy like a lion's mane. Jamie picked up his rifle. They crept forward to the edge of the trees. "You'll have a clear shot," Caleb breathed. "Wait." Jamie cocked the gun, bent his cheek to the stock. The bull moved closer. Through the sight, Jamie watched him lift his head, tilt it so the thick branches of his antlers tipped parallel to his back. His black nose pinched and quivered. His eyes showed white at their inner corners, urgent with the rut. "Now," Caleb whispered. The animal was rough and heavy with life. Jamie imagined the legs crumpling, the magnificent antlers lying in the grass like discarded pitchforks. He lowered the rifle. Reflexively, Caleb lifted his, accustomed to taking the shots others missed. "Don't," Jamie said. The bull elk looked toward them, ears swiveling. Jamie jumped up, waving his arms. He shouted. The animal turned and ran, setting the cows galloping. Dull thunder as the herd streamed down the meadow, their cream-colored haunches flashing bright until the fog swallowed them. England, August to November 1942, just after Marion arrived in London. First, Marion and the others were sent to Luton, north of London, for ground school and flight checks. Everyone, men and women, had to begin at the beginning, regardless of experience. "You might have 2,000 hours," the instructor said, "or you might have two. And you'll still have to sit here and listen, and you'll still have to pass the tests." They wore civilian clothes. Their uniforms were being made in London at Austin Reed, were issued big amorphous Sidcot suits for flying. Ground school Marion found very interesting, as she'd never learned about aerodynamics, except haphazardly and long ago in the Missoula library, and she'd never learned Morse code or studied in a systematic way navigation or meteorology. This was the school of her young dreams, rows of desks occupied by pilots, walls plastered with maps and charts and diagrams of engines and instruments. Safe, not brave. Their instructor repeated this often enough for it to be a kind of mantra. Their purpose was to safely and efficiently transport airplanes wherever they were needed, not to be heroes. The planes were to be undamaged, or at least not damaged further than they already were. Sometimes they'd be flying brand new aircraft, sometimes battle-bruised ones. Sometimes they'd be taxiing each other home in tired old crates. The ATA operated under what Marion considered a clever and audacious system. After completing flight school at Luton in light aircraft, mostly open biplanes, and logging enough cross-country flights, pilots were sent to headquarters at White Waltham, south of London, and were trained to fly single-engine fighters known as Class II, which included Hawker Hurricanes and, after a proving period, the longed-for Spitfires. Once they'd proved themselves capable, pilots were posted to one of 14 ferry pools. The northernmost was Lossiemouth in Scotland, the southernmost Hamble near Southampton, where the Supermarine Factory churned out Spitfires that needed clearing away before the Germans could bomb them. Each pilot was issued a small book, bound at its top with two metal rings. Ferry pilot's notes and "for official use only," stamped in yellow on its blue canvas cover. This contained information on every plane they might fly. They would be expected to take off in unfamiliar models after only a quick perusal of the notes. If they did well with Class IIs, they would return to White Waltham to upgrade to Class III, light twin-engine planes, and so on up to Class V, the hulking four-engine heavy bombers. Class VI was flying boats, but women were not allowed to fly those, as they would need to be put among a male crew, an intrusion that could only result in chaos. "Chief amongst your concerns," said the instructor, "will be flying below the weather. If you can't, stay on the ground. To avoid attracting attention, you won't be using radios. And if your aircraft has guns, they won't be loaded." He hesitated. "That is, in theory. If you should happen to find yourself in an armed aircraft, under no circumstances are you to fire your weapons." Here, some of the pilots exchanged rebellious glances. "You'll be completely on your own, so remember, safe, not brave," chorused the pilots. "I'll never understand why they won't teach instruments," Marion said to Ruth as they walked back to their billets, two little brick houses on the same street, occupied by families who happened to have spare rooms. Marion's room belonged to a son gone to Canada for RAF training. A model of a Sopwith Camel biplane hung from the ceiling, and on her first night she had lain looking at the underside of the wings and wondering what had ever happened to the Breyfogles. She'd always thought more about Felix, but now she wondered about Trixie. She ought to have admired her. "It's not as though you can help it if weather closes in on you," she continued to Ruth. "They say they don't want to waste planes and pilots, but you'd think fewer would crash if they knew how to fly in cloud." "The bosses are cheap, plain and simple," said Ruth, "and in a big old hurry. Do you know how to fly on instruments?" "Nope," Ruth said cheerily. "But I'm planning to be safe, not brave. Anyway, look at Amy Johnson. She knew what she was doing, and she still packed it in." Marion was skeptical of this logic. They were standing at the little wrought iron gate to Ruth's billet. "I could teach you some things," Marion said, "just in case. Only if we have our lessons at the pub. I'm getting enough school." "You won't listen there. Then we'll reward ourselves after with trips to the pub." "Twist my arm," Marion said, waving goodbye. After a few hours up with an instructor in plotting tiger moths and Miles Magisters, open to the wind and rain, Marion soloed. Funny to solo after years of flying alone, but she refrained from smirking or complaining, dutifully entered the occasion in her new logbook. After soloing, the next step was 25 cross-country flights around Britain, navigating by compass and paper map, following railroads and rivers and Roman roads. Quick hops. The mosaic landscape droned by below, grouted with hedges. On good weather days, she could knock off three or four flights. She was still adjusting to the smallness of this country, which could fit in Alaska's pocket. But fine days were interspersed with more that hung low and gray. sometimes turning flyable only after the pilots had been told to clear off home. Even when the weather was passable, a dirty miasma hung over Luton, stinging Marion's eyes as she passed through in her open biplane. After Dunkirk, the Vauxhall Auto Factory there had been converted to produce Churchill tanks and army trucks, and the smoke from its chimneys mingled in a dense, acrid soup with smoke from houses and from the smudge pots intended to shield the factory from German bombers. Elsewhere, everywhere, it seemed. She had to worry about barrage balloons tethered on chains around airfields and factories to ensnare or at least deter German planes. Both Marion and Ruth had Monday as their day off and adopted a routine of going to London on Sunday evenings. They usually saw a movie or a play and spent the night at the Red Cross Club, which was cheaper than a hotel and more fun. There was a penny jukebox and a good snack bar and central heat, and American soldiers and nurses were always around, and sometimes pilots they knew. At the PX, they bought salted peanuts and Nestle bars and cans of beer. Several times, they were obliged to go for uniform fittings at Austin Reed. They were to have a skirt, a pair of trousers, two tunics, a jacket, and a greatcoat, all in RAF blue. Cut uncomfortably tight for Marion's taste, not tight enough for Ruth's. Some of the more sophisticated girls, ones like Zip, who'd gone to fancy colleges, or who were especially beautiful, like Sylvie, got invited to cocktails at the embassy or for dinner at Jackie Cochran's flat in Knightsbridge. But Ruth and Marion were happy enough to spend most of their time as a solitary pair or with the transient acquaintances Ruth was always picking up. "I'm surprised you're not Jackie's favorite," Marion said to Ruth once after they'd run into Sylvie on the street, who'd let slip that Jackie had served real blueberries the night before. "You'd think she'd want you around to charm all her impressive friends." "No," Ruth had said, drawing on her cigarette and squinting in contemplation. "I'm too brassy. No one can say Jackie's not remarkable, but she's not really fun deep down. She tries, but you can see the strain. Just as well. I'm glad not to have any more obligations." "If you don't mind, then I don't," said Marion. "I'd be sorry to be left out if you were invited, and she'd never invite me. She probably thinks I'd show up in a burlap sack." "No, it's the opposite. You're the one she'd have if we weren't thick as thieves. She'd like to improve you." Ruth linked her arm through Marion's and rested her head against her shoulder. "Silly goose doesn't see there's nothing that could possibly be improved." But in September, Jackie was gone, back to America, to head up an all-female domestic version of the ATA, the WASP. No more cocktails in Knightsbridge. Helen Ritchie, famous for being the first female commercial pilot in the United States, was put in charge of the American contingent. But by then, Jackie's girls were deep into their training, with little need for a den mother. Everyone in London seemed to drink a lot, to never sleep enough, to be ravenous for fun. The mood in the nightclubs and dance halls was deliriously defiant. And Ruth led Marion into the thick of things. Ruth was a flirt, but never let any of the men even kiss her, so far as Marion knew. She always talked about her husband on nights out, more than she did other times. Marion, though, if the hour was late, might let a man kiss her in a shadowy corner of a dance floor. Or she might let her knees part as someone ran his hand up her leg in a dark taxi. If there had been an opportunity, she might have done more. But always, Ruth appeared and laughingly but firmly extricated her, shepherded her back to the chaste dormitory rooms of the Red Cross. Slowly, Marion had grown accustomed to the blackout and to discerning the people moving through it like benthic fish, flashing their white gloves or phosphorescent boutonnieres. She enjoyed the shock of passing from the outdoor darkness into a nightclub, loud and humid, sparkling like the inside of a geode. Here was the subterranean persistence of life. The peaceful world had been burned away, but its roots were intact, safe down in the dark, nourished by booze, smoke, and sweat. One especially frigid night, Ruth and Marion were put on fire watch together, which meant they were to sleep on cots at the Luton airfield. By 8 o'clock, when it had long been dark and there was nothing to do but sleep, they lay shivering on their cots in their wool underwear and Sidcot suit liners until Ruth said, "Do you think you could bear to squeeze in with me? I'm so cold I'll never fall asleep." "All right," Marion said, and Ruth lifted the blankets for her. Lying back to back, Marion felt acutely conscious of the slight difference in the rhythm of their breathing. But when she synchronized herself to Ruth, the feeling was even stranger, as though they had fused into a pair of lungs. She was aware, too, of the softness of Ruth's rear against her own, aligned since Ruth, much shorter than she, had scooted down and covered her whole head with the blankets. Marion knew she could sleep. She could always sleep, anywhere. But she was not sure she wanted to. "I haven't heard from my brother in a while," she offered. "Not since we arrived." Ruth scooted up above the covers so her voice was unmuffled. "Maybe his letters just stuck somewhere. I got a batch yesterday and some of them were ancient."
"Maybe."
"I had a letter from Eddie. He's gotten his crew now. They sound all right. One guy gets airsick every time, but no one tattles on him. Not even after he decided to drop his barf bag down the flare chute and the wind blew it back up and splattered everyone. Their last training flight was over water, so he thinks it won't be too much longer before they go overseas." She shifted, her shoulders pressing against Marion's. "He said they're all getting along, which is a relief." Marion had little sense of Eddie, beyond the fact that he'd washed out of pilot training.
"Were you worried?"
"A bit. People don't always know what to make of Eddie. Don't get me wrong, he's terrific, but sometimes, I don't know." Ruth rolled over, squeaking the cot springs. Now the softness against Marion's back was breasts instead of rump. "You're warm," Ruth said. She snaked her arm under Marion's and held her hand in front of Marion's face. There were red, swollen patches at her knuckles. "Do you have these? Chilblains? They're awful. I have them on my feet, too."
"You need to do a better job drying your socks and boots," Marion said, and it seemed natural to take Ruth's hand in her own and draw it beneath the covers,
holding it against her sternum to warm it. "Your heart is beating fast," Ruth said after a minute.
"I don't think so."
"It is," this in a loose, sleepy voice. Marion didn't answer. Something about the way Ruth talked about Eddie was odd. The elliptical idea came to her that if she were Ruth, she would figure it out. Ruth would get everything out of Ruth without even seeming to try. She found she wanted to go to sleep quickly, before Ruth could change position again, and so she did, falling away into herself. England, November to December 1942, continuing on. A letter finally came from Jamie, dated back in September. He was going to be an artist in the Navy.
Who would have thought such a thing existed? I wouldn't have, but Sarah Fahey wrote to tell me. At first, I thought I should just enlist anyway, but I came around to thinking maybe I should do this instead. After all, they want artists, and I am one. I leave for training in San Diego soon, and from there, I don't know. I hope you won't worry, at least not as much as I worry about you.
So it was done. The war had come for Jamie, too. Worry wasn't the word for what she felt. Dread, perhaps, anticipatory grief for what he would see, how he would be changed. Caleb was gone to the army, too, but there was nothing she could do for either of them. So she tried to set her fears aside. As winter approached, the worsening weather made cross-country flights more and more difficult to complete. So in early November, when Marion had done only 18 instead of 25, the ATA shrugged off its own requirement and gave her her wings and 4 days leave. Ruth still needed to catch a few more flights, so Marion went to London alone, but found that without Ruth, even the most familiar parts of the city made her shy and tentative. The Red Cross Club, so lively and welcoming in Ruth's company, felt daunting. She'd come to rely on Ruth to swing her into conversations like a trapeze artist, tossing her partner into another's grip. When an Air Force captain tried to strike up a conversation in the snack bar, she managed only the most stilted chit-chat and fled at the first opportunity. She was, she abruptly understood, in love with Ruth. This realization in those words came to her fully, finally, on her second day in London. She was at Austin Reed picking up her uniforms, standing and looking at herself in a cheval mirror while the tailor fussed with the cuffs of her blue jacket, and she wished Ruth were there to fill the awkward silence with chatter. And as she thought about Ruth, she saw her own face change. She recognized her flushed and fearful expression in a way she had not been able to recognize the inward sensations from which it sprang. And the knowledge shocked her, both that the object of her love was a woman. Besides the woman in Cordova, she'd never thought much about women. And that she was capable, after Barclay, after so many years up in the north trying to freeze her heart solid and let the wind erode it down to nothing, of falling for anyone at all. But the question was what to do, and the answer was nothing. Ruth was a warm and loving friend, but surely she would find Marion's feelings strange or disgusting or frightening. Ruth was married. Marion thought she might have sensed a charge between them the night they'd slept nestled together on fire watch. But surely that had been in her imagination. Surely Ruth had only been keeping warm. Surely there was no way Ruth would ever be interested in. Marion didn't know how to name what she wanted. Possession, maybe. Touch, certainly. Closeness they already had. But Marion wanted something more purposefully important. She couldn't risk explaining such desires to Ruth. Ruth would want nothing more to do with her, and that consequence was unacceptable. Although, even as Marion told herself this, she could not entirely believe that Ruth would banish her. Ruth always seemed to understand. Why should she not understand this, too? Because it was deviant. Because it was offensive. Because Ruth would be horrified and betrayed. In any case, even if by some miracle Ruth understood, understanding was different from reciprocation. Understanding without reciprocation would have the same result as revulsion, really. The loss of Ruth. Had Marion fallen in love right when they first met without even knowing it? When Ruth had taken her chin in her hand and studied her? She had fallen when Barclay looked at her at Miss Dolly's. Why did she respond so to being looked at? Once, the sirens had sounded when she and Ruth were at the Red Cross Club. But rather than going down into the shelter, they'd gone up on the roof, into the calamitous night. Everyone said the sporadic raids were nothing compared to the worst of the Blitz, when huge pink mountains of smoke had seemed to dwarf the sky itself. But still, there was the grinding throb of German engines, the soft burst of incendiaries, the dumb blank faces of the barrage balloons, planes caught like moths in the sweep of searchlights. Bombs thudded against the city. Anti-aircraft shells flashed white in the sky. Beyond, visible in patches through the smoke and drifting cloud, The stars shone impassively. Fires had burned, though not near the Red Cross, and Marion had wondered if there were people inside the flames. Of course there were, but still she hoped that somehow there were not. Ruth, without looking away from the spectacle, had taken Marion's hand. What disproportionate comfort Ruth's small hand had brought, her warm grip seeming to counterbalance the city lying belly up, growing brighter and brighter as the flames spread. As she left Austin Reed with her heavy parcel of uniforms, Marion didn't know how she would face Ruth, how she could pretend nothing had changed. The feeling of safety and ease would be gone, and Ruth's presence would bring only loneliness and longing. She should wait for her infatuation to pass. People could fall out of love. It seemed almost inevitable that they did. And if she stepped back from the giddy immediacy of her feelings, she saw mercy in the impossibility of their fulfillment. She could not be trapped by love again. She would not be. When she returned to the Red Cross Club, it seemed like divine providence that instructions were waiting for her. She was not to go back to Luton, but straight on to White Waltham to upgrade to Class 2 airplanes. She would not have to face Ruth. Not right away. White Waltham was in a pleasant market town called Maidenhead. Lord, that name, Ruth had said, with timbered houses along a sedate stretch of the Thames. Marion found a room in a small hotel not far from the airfield that was only a bit more expensive than a billet. Back to the ATA classroom she went, to learn about superchargers and carburetors and on and on. After 2 weeks of lectures, she was in the air again, in Harvard's like the one she'd checked out on in Montreal, startling in their power after all her puttering cross-country flights in Tigers and Magisters. There was a new American club nearby, with a pool, closed for the winter, and a terrace and snack bar. She went sometimes for cocktails with other pilots, but said little. No one tried to draw her out as Ruth had. Had she always been so uncertain about how to talk to people? She couldn't remember how she had been before Barclay, before Alaska. She bought a motorbike and rode around the countryside when she had free time and enough gas coupons. She went to Henley and watched people rowing on the river. She rode past Eton College, where boys played rugby in the fields and loitered in tailcoats outside crenellated brick buildings. She rode past villages where you'd never know there was a war, past others that were little more than bomb craters, past the wreckage of a B-17 among a stand of beech trees. Mostly, she rode past grass and trees, stone walls, sheep. One afternoon, after flying circuits and bumps in a Harvard, she came into the flight office, and there was Ruth, blue uniformed and grinning. "Howdy, stranger," she said. Marion's first response was joy, then terrified dismay, and Ruth, who had stepped forward for a hug, noticed the shift and faltered. Their hug was off-kilter, as stiff as an embrace between two mannequins. "I was going to write and tell you I got my wings and my togs," Ruth said. She struck a fashion model pose in her uniform. "I got seconded to Ratcliffe for a bit. Mostly I'm the taxi service." She pointed out the window at a Fairchild 24. "That's me. But then I got sent down here and I thought I might run into you and save the postage." "Congratulations." Marion turned to study the big map of Britain on the wall, updated daily with locations of barrage balloons and no-fly zones. "You went off to London and then not a peep," Ruth said. "It's been busy." Ruth waited for more. When none came, she said, "You've probably missed me, though, even though you haven't written." Stricken, Marion looked from the map to her boots. Ruth stepped closer. "You're acting so peculiar. Has something happened?"
Did I do something wrong?
Nothing. I'm not feeling right, that's all. Marion swung her parachute onto her shoulder. I have to go. Ruth didn't call after her, didn't follow. Marion, riding her motorbike back to her hotel, saw the Fairchild take off and disappear. 2 weeks later, on a rare, clear-skied day in mid-December, Marion got her first spit. She'd delivered a hurricane to Salisbury, and without fanfare, the ops officer there pushed the new chit across the counter. The plane was waiting, its long, perforated cowling angled up at the sky. It had been camouflaged for photo reconnaissance, and except for its black prop and its roundels and tricolor, the whole of it was cornflower blue, as though the sky had stuck to it. It had no armor and no guns, so it would be light and fast, able to reach its ceiling quickly, over 40,000 feet, and carry enough fuel to get to Germany and back. The female members of the ATA were unanimous that the Spitfire, hero of the Battle of Britain and symbol of RAF pluckiness aloft, was, in fact, a woman's plane. The cockpit was petite. A woman slid into it like a finger into a glove. The controls responded to the softest touch. Men, they all agreed, tried to muscle the thing too much, wanted to dominate it out of its most essential grace. One of the English girls had lost her pilot fiancé when he tried to take off in a spit with an air traffic controller on his lap, larkily giving him a lift somewhere, and couldn't pull the stick back far enough because the cockpit was too full of male bodies. Both had been killed. Marion climbed into the cockpit, consulted the ferry notes, began her checks. She had flown plenty of hurricanes, which she liked and which weren't so different from the spit. But there was something newly thrilling about this plane, the close hug of its cockpit, how the controls seemed to press up eagerly under her hands and feet. The engine started with a harsh rattle, settled into a steady popping, a textured drone. Marion wasted no time taxiing, since spits were prone to overheating on the ground. She swung the nose from side to side, peering around to see where she was going. In no time at all, the cockpit was warm enough to make her sweat. This was a plane meant to be in the air. On the runway, she throttled up. The muddy field rushed alongside, a bounce over a rut, and the ground released her. The spit was needed in Colerne in Wiltshire, not far. She dawdled on the way, turning a forbidden roll, a loop, carving and slicing the sky with the thin elliptical wings, the earth swinging up and over. Under the Perspex dome, she was the hinge of it all, the swivel point. She went into a steep climb, leveled off, 10,000 feet, higher already than she was supposed to fly. There was a pressurization system, but the note said to keep it off, as low-flying ferry pilots should have no call for it. She didn't know how to turn it on anyway. She would just go a little higher. Another nudge to the throttle. 300 miles per hour. She wanted to smear the plane into the sky, blue on blue. Up. 15,000 feet. She needed to be careful not to get carried away, but she felt well in control. Below, Britain was molded to the Earth's curvature. Fields and hedges slid over it like iridescence over the surface of a soap bubble. Up, 17,000 feet. She must pay attention. Come down soon. The air was meager in her lungs. She remembered the skipping of the Travel Air's engine when she'd flown too high over Missoula. Why did she have this impulse to throw herself at boundaries, be flung back by them? She felt the beginnings of fear, like frostbite beginning in the warm core of her instead of on her skin. In the thin air, the plane traveled faster, nearly 400 miles per hour. She couldn't stay long. Up, though. She needed to find out what was up there, to be away from what was below, away from Ruth, away from the world where Jamie was in the war. Cold now, much too high, but only a little bit farther and she would know what she wanted to know. She was sure of it. The engine seemed to grow quiet, but still the altimeter's arrow swept to the right. The sky turned midnight blue at the edges of her vision, darkness bleeding up and inward as though she were sinking into something. After she landed and taxied in and switched off the engine, Marion sat in the cockpit, quite still. Cold lingered in her. Her head ached. Her hand trembled when she finally opened the canopy. She walked to the ops office, handed over her chit, received a new one. A Miles Master needing transport to Wrexham. "Everything all right?" said the officer who took her chit. "You're a bit green around the gills." "Fine, I'll just have a coffee before I go." She made her way to the canteen, and there, sitting at a table reading a newspaper, was Ruth. The world narrowed to Ruth as it had to that last point of light, flickering through the propeller before she'd fallen unconscious. Ruth looked up blankly at the sound of Marion's footsteps. Then she was standing and coming toward her.
"Are you all right?" she said. "You look completely wrung out."
Only two pilots were in the canteen, both men, absorbed in their newspapers.
"Just a headache."
"When did you get so fragile? Next you'll be telling me you have the vapors."
Marion glanced at the pilots. "I thought a coffee would help."
"I'll get it," Ruth said. "Go outside, get some fresh air. I'll meet you."
The brick of the building was cold against Marion's back, but the sun warmed her face, hurt her eyes. Squinting, she took the mug Ruth brought her. The coffee was abrasively bitter, but very hot.
"What's going on with you?" Ruth said. "You're acting so strange."
"What are you doing here?" Marion asked. Ruth seemed to decide against pressing her, said,
"Taxi service, what else? They must think I'm all right at it since it's all I do. Once in a blue moon, I ferry a moth. Yippee. Where would the war effort be without one more decrepit biplane? But next week, I'm finally going back to White Waltham. We'll be reunited."
This last with forced cheer. "I might have left by then." Ruth dug in her pocket for cigarettes. When she'd lit one, she said,
"We've gotten out of sync, haven't we?"
Marion indicated the plane parked by the hangar. "I'll probably be posted soon. I've just done my first spit."
"The blue one? How was it?"
When she had come to, she had been in a spiraling dive, a pinwheel of fields and hedges spinning into a blur.
"Like everyone says. Heaven?"
"Just about."
"I'm dying of jealousy."
Neither said anything for a minute. The coffee and the oxygen-rich air were helping Marion's headache, though Ruth's smoke wasn't. Ruth added,
"If you'd written, I would have told you Eddie's here now, in a training unit at Bovingdon."
"Really?"
"Yes, really."
She was growing cool, remembering Marion's neglect.
"I'm glad for you."
Marion knew she didn't sound glad at all. She'd never known jealousy like this, the sting of it. A distant engine sang a single nasal note, crescendoed as it came closer. A Spitfire appeared, lined up, landed.
"My passenger's here," Ruth said. "Time to go."
She stubbed out her cigarette on the brick wall, put the butt in her pocket.
"See you, Graves."
She was walking away. Marion said,
"Ruth."
Ruth turned. Everything Marion wanted to say was stuck in her throat.
"See you."
Ruth seemed to droop. A sadness emanated from her that Marion didn't understand.
"Sure," she said.
Marion was posted to the number 6 ferry pool at Ratcliffe before Ruth arrived at White Waltham. And again, she was relieved, and still, she did not write.
Trust your lust. 16. Picture! Bart shouted. Lock it down! No talking, please! Settle in, please! Sound rolling. Camera. Swinging a lens and we'll go again. Hold the work. Hold the talk. Last look. First team is in. Life is full of sound. And film sets are full of silence. We were shooting in a retro music venue in downtown LA. A big, balconied room made up to look like a wartime London nightclub. Extras were strategically distributed to make the place seem jammed. And they mimed chatter and laughter and moved noiselessly through the dance floor's revolving spangles, sweating in their costumes because air conditioning would make too much noise. They danced in silence, while the white jacketed swing band pretended to play. Trombone slides going in and out, while the band leader conducted to music that only existed in the tiny buds in his ears. After the Alexi kiss hit the internet, I wasn't allowed to talk. Siobhan and our emergency PR triage people said it was best to issue a statement saying I would not be commenting about my private life and let everyone scream into the void. Outside, on the hot white sidewalk, guys in black t-shirts pushed around rattling dollies piled with utilitarian bric-a-brac, rolls of tape, coils of cable, tripods, racks of lights, big squares of rubber flooring. Trucks and trailers clogged the street. Hair and makeup girls bustled around, their belts heavy with brushes and clips and spray bottles and big nylon pockets like the ones animal trainers carry treats in. I swayed and turned with actor Eddie in the middle of a crowd of other swaying, turning couples who, if the real Marion Graves had danced in a club like this, would have been absorbed in their own lives, but were now just props meant to plump up my world, make it look real. A camera orbited around me, and a boom hung over my head like a fuzzy black moon, and I was supposed to be falling for my friend's husband. Ruth's my friend, I told Eddie. Ruth's not here, he said. And tomorrow, I'm going to fly over Germany, and I might never come back. So, what do you say? If I ever had a real meltdown, if I ever well and truly lost my shit, at least inside my own head, it was that week after Vegas. Alexi didn't return my texts or calls. He didn't make any public statements. Finally, he emailed me that he had a lot to sort out and needed to concentrate on his family and didn't want to have any contact, at least for a while. What I wanted was to scrape my whole life away, cast aside everyone I knew because everyone I knew had disappointed me, build a new existence from scratch. I wanted to escape the system of my past, all the chain reactions. I wanted to be the Big Bang. But instead, I took a bottle of scotch over to Sir Hugo's. MG drove me the 100 feet between our gates because the paparazzi were basically eating each other alive at the bottom of my driveway. My dear, you are becoming a toxic asset, Hugo said frostily. You're lucky we can't fire you. We were standing in his kitchen, and he was filling 2 glasses nearly to the brim. Last time you said I'd made myself interesting. There are limits. We need women to see this movie, and women generally aren't enamored of homewreckers. I know it's unfair. I know it takes 2 to tango, but there you have it. We want people to look at you and see Marion Graves, not think about the chaotic tabloid strumpet who keeps getting caught shagging the wrong people. He clinked his glass against mine. Chin chin. I took a swallow. This thing with Alexei didn't really feel optional. Nothing as insignificant as the dignity of his wife or the prospect of total ruin would have stopped me. I saw a bumper sticker once in LA. Trust your lust. This is not prudent advice. Is it over? I hope so, but I hope not. Hugo pierced at me. Are you in love with Lexi Young? I set my glass down, covered my face with both hands, nodded. But not just since Vegas. Hugo was no fool. I uncovered my eyes. No. Well, remind yourself that you'd probably love him much less if you were actually with him, because that's the way it always plays out. Relish the pining and leave it at that. Spice of life. He opened a cupboard. I wouldn't say no to something to nibble on, would you? He came out with a box of water crackers and a jar of mustard. What about young Mr. Pfeiffer? I thought there might be something there. I thought there was. Then I thought there wasn't. Then I thought maybe. And now I think I ruined whatever might have been. Hugo spread mustard on a cracker. Well, that's probably for the best. For the sake of the film. I'd thought this movie would save me. Elevate me, like Hugo had said. Lift me up and carry me away. But I was too heavy for it. I was going to drag it down. Do you think the movie's going to be good? I asked. That depends on a lot of things, including you. But I hope so. What can I do? Unfortunately, there's not much you can do, except act, said Hugo. Ideally, extremely well. And for God's sake, don't go to bed with anyone else. Not a soul. I have been acting. I've seen the dailies. They're adequate. But I can still see you. And frankly, you are the last person I want to see. Tell me how not to be seen. Please. He waved a hand. I can't tell you. Anyway, I don't believe for a minute that's what you want. You want to be seen so very badly. You reek of it. You're terrified of what happens if no one's looking at you. No, I want to disappear, I said. Really, I want the ground to swallow me up. No. He swallowed a mouthful of cracker. You don't. You want people to wonder where you went. That night, after maybe a touch too much weed, I was sure my whole house was watching me. I knew there were cameras and listening devices hidden in every light fixture, every pen, every electronic gadget, and I went outside to get away from them. But being outside in the dark by the pool was terrifying, too. The Santa Anas were up, and everything was dry and rustling and rattling. I needed to know I wouldn't always feel the way I did, so I called Redwood. I'd seen him on set, but only fleetingly. We hadn't mentioned Alexei. We hadn't mentioned what I'd texted him from Vegas. We hadn't really mentioned anything. He sounded wary when he answered. I'm sorry to call so late, I said. Or maybe at all, because I know things are weird, but I'm freaking out. My words came out in a pathetic squeal. I'm having a really hard time, and... And what? What could I possibly ask of this person I barely knew? And I don't know what's okay to say to you. I heard him take a deep breath, in through his nose and out through his mouth, the way they teach you in yoga. I should have replied to your text, he said. I was going to. I just needed to think. But then the next day, the Alexei story was everywhere, and I felt pretty confused. More confused. Because I was already quite confused. About what? He spoke quietly, as though he were trying not to be overheard. I like you, and I don't presume to know how you feel about me or what you want, but I need to be careful. He trailed off, then restarted. Like, one minute you're texting me that you miss me, and the next you're having this thing with Alexei Young. It feels a little dramatic. For what it's worth, I said. There's history there. He was silent, and I went on. I didn't know he was coming to Vegas. I thought it was over. It had been over for a long time. When he spoke again, his tone was softer. You don't owe me an explanation. But, on the other hand, I think knowing that does make me feel a little better. Okay, good. What's going on with that? With you and him? Nothing. It's over again. Because of him or you? I wanted to lie, but I said, him. That's honest, at least. Will you come over? Just to hang out? He hesitated. He said, I can't. Leanne's here. Oh, well then, I won't take up any more of your time. He didn't say anything for a few seconds. She and I are friends. Now I hesitated, then plunged. How come nothing happened the night I stayed over? Another big gap of silence. I'm trying this thing, he said, where I have to know the women I sleep with. We'd talked all day. It was still just a day. I couldn't decide if he was being ridiculous or if I was. Are you single? Silence again. Then, yes. I heard her voice in the background. But I should go. Just one more thing, I said, not wanting him to hang up. It scared me how irrelevant Redwood had seemed when Alexei was around, and how essential he seemed now that no one was around. I was thinking, Adelaide Scott said it's good to know what you don't want, and I don't want to be a wrecking ball anymore. I want to hang out with someone I actually like. Okay, he said quietly. Well, we'll talk. But I really do have to go. After we hung up, I thought about texting Travis Day, asking him to come over. But I didn't. That was something, at least. Where was my medal? My prize for impulse control? And the night didn't scare me anymore. It was just wind. Just leaves brushing together. My house wasn't watching me. Nothing was watching me. I was a dumbass sitting by a swimming pool in the dark, feeling unloved and sorry for myself, but also, suddenly and pleasantly, invisible.
The War. Alaska, February to May 1943, 6 weeks later. In the letter he received with his orders, Jamie had been informed his task was to express, if you can, realistically or symbolically, the essence or spirit of war. What the essence or spirit of war was, the letter did not disclose. He was allowed to state a preference for where he went, and he requested Alaska, not because he thought it the most likely location for the essence of war, but because he was curious to see the place that had held Marion's attention. And he thought he might as well work inward from the war's edges. On the naval transport from San Francisco to Kodiak, Jamie sketched soldiers playing cards or sunbathing on deck. He painted them stacked in their bunks, their skin nicotine yellow in the sickly glow of the hanging light fixtures that swung sickeningly with the roll of the ocean. The ship, before, had transported cattle, and Jamie thought its new purpose was not so different, still involved livestock. He stood watch like everyone else, just as in basic training he'd marched and drilled and shot and jogged like everyone else, had sailed around San Diego Harbor in a whaleboat and slept in a hammock. At night, some of the boots had cried but tried to muffle the sound. Others ground their teeth so loudly it echoed. For a week, he saw only water. Despite the spreading V of the wake, despite the shifting colors of the sky and the low passage of the winter sun, the ship seemed to be just churning in place, always at the center of the same flat disk of empty sea. The rest of the world seemed irrelevant. His father's life had been spent at the center of such disks. Over time, what did that do to a person? He tried to paint the roar and blast of the engine room, the green-white crust of sea spray that froze to the railings, the band of pale sky at the horizon, the prow chopping down on the white-capped swells, sending up walls of spray. Titanium white, Davy's gray, indigo, blue-black. Some guys heckled him about his sketching and painting. Some seemed worried about him. They asked if he knew how to shoot his rifle. He only said yes and no more. He'd been one of the best shots in boot camp, payoff from all the tin cans he'd blasted to smithereens as a child. In Kodiak, he was told to report to a captain. He showed his orders, explained he was the combat artist.
"Christ, what next?" said the captain. "All right, what do you need?"
"I'm not sure," said Jamie. "I'm supposed to go around painting what I see." He didn't want to explain how really the point was to interpret what he saw. The captain didn't strike him as someone who would relish being interpreted.
"Sounds great. They'll surrender in no time now you're here. Carry on."
Jamie sent off the paintings he'd made on the voyage and began new ones, working with stiff fingers and numb toes through the short, cold days. The inner parts of Kodiak's harbor were frozen in a flat pane, titanium white, that ended in a crisp edge against the open water, Mars black. Slabs of ice, padded on top with new snow, broke off and floated away. Sometimes the glossy black fins of orcas sliced up, rolled down through the water's surface like the turning cogs of submerged wheels. Bears came to forage through the garbage. Sea lions, Van Dyke brown, a little Venetian red, lay in heaps on the docks and rocks, roaring and biting. The females were smaller and tawnier than the males, bullied and put upon, with tragic black eyes. Jamie painted the mud and snow, the barracks and hangars and storage buildings, the jeeps and lumber piles. He painted a trawler tied up next to a submarine, a destroyer plastered with snow along its broadside after a blizzard, two P-38 Lightnings silhouetted against a snowy peak. The snow was white. Sometimes the sky was white. Sometimes the sea, too. He would need more white paint, more gray and blue and ochre, more Naples yellow for the tender winter light. He hadn't used watercolors much since his boyhood, but he returned to them, leaving patches of the paper dry and bare for snow, adding faint streaks and blotches of gray to suggest the dimensions of the mountains. If he was idle, he felt guilty and conspicuous. Though, of course, he was much more conspicuous when he was working. An eccentric figure at an easel, some on-plein-air fanatic obliviously scraping away with his brushes in the middle of a war. This was what the Navy wanted him to do, he reminded himself. We believe we are giving you the opportunity to bring back a record of great value to your country, the letter had said. Had the letter been sincere? Sometimes he felt almost mocked by it. He ate meat because it seemed impossible not to. He drank, but not too much. Before he learned to lash down his boards and canvases, more than one had been lifted off his easel by the wind, sent cartwheeling through the mud to lodge against the wheels of some machine or smash into the side of a building, leaving a smear of color. The barracks' interiors were collaged with women, barrel-vaulted Quonset huts dently papered with smiling movie stars and nameless models, the way some cathedral ceilings were crowded with angels and apostles. The women from home, the real women, were kept in pockets or pinned above bunks and washstands like patron saints. Men were always showing their sweethearts and wives to Jamie, proudly, anxiously. They worried their girls wouldn't wait. Not that they themselves usually turned down the chance to stray if it arose. You just want someone to touch you, the guys said. There was no point in feeling guilty. In the nurses' quarters were photos of men in uniform. They worried those men would die, but also that they would stray. Is someone waiting for you at home? This was a nurse, Diane, who showed Jamie a photo of her parents and another of her sister in a whack uniform. Nope, he admitted. No one at all. On their first outing, he kissed her in the lee of a boulder. After their second, a dance in the officers' club, in the cab of a bulldozer left unlocked, he put his hand down her woolen trousers. She lifted her hips and he tugged off her pants, maneuvered around the bulldozer's various levers and knobs until he could wedge himself between her knees. She gave him a little nod and he pushed into her. He hadn't been with anyone in months, didn't last long, pulled out and came into his handkerchief. Then followed an awkward parting, a heavy melancholy filled with thoughts of Sarah. The captain had decided he liked Jamie's paintings. He asked gruffly if Jamie would paint one of the harbor for him personally. When Jamie delivered it, the captain asked where he wanted to go next. To the action, Jamie said, though that word made him queasy, chipper, dishonest shorthand for violent death. The captain said he would see what he could do. Jamie was put on the passenger manifest of a shovel-faced PBY Catalina seaplane bound for Dutch Harbor. 5 days in a row they tried to go, but the weather was terrible. 3 days they didn't even take off, the other two they turned back. He stopped bothering to say goodbye to Diane. On the sixth day, finally on their way, over the ocean with only gray cloud in the windows, the plane jolted and bounced with awful swoops and groans. And Jamie held his paint box against his chest, closed his eyes. Almost daily, planes and crews vanished into the Bering Sea, downed by weather more often than enemy fire. He wished Marion were flying the plane. In Dutch Harbor, bombed by the Japanese 6 months earlier but mostly repaired, he made more paintings, sent them off. Planes were smudges in the sky, one or two small brushstrokes each. He wasn't there long, was only waiting to go west again, following the sweep of the perforated Aleutian arm toward Attu and Kiska, tiny, muddy, storm-scoured islands far out in the chain that the Japanese had invaded in June and needed routing from. He was lucky with his flight to Adak. Arriving at all was lucky, and at times the clouds had even broken open, revealing the islands below, steep, snow-capped, smoke-plumed volcanic cones sloping down into collars of sheer cliffs fringed by waves. He stayed in a Quonset hut with a cohort of army journalist types. Adak Press Club, said a sign on their door. The Seabees had filled in a lagoon with bulldozed volcanic ash and hammered down perforated steel planking to make a runway. After a storm, planes returning from bombing runs would land in standing water, their propellers driving up dense clouds of mist as they hurtled down the runway in angry white puffs, only their noses and wing edges visible. The Japanese flew over sometimes, strafing and bombing, usually not doing much damage. The Tundra swallowed their bullets and bombs.
"We do better than that, don't we?" Jamie said to an army photographer after an attack.
The man gazed after the departing planes.
"Yeah, their mud is probably much more shot up than ours."
Jamie was loitering outside the hospital huts when a man, wounded by a bomb, was unloaded from a jeep, part of his jaw missing, his uniform soaked with blood. The photographer came running, ducking behind his camera. The man held up a sticky red hand, warding him off. Jamie sketched the man from memory later, but felt dirty about it. There had been a helpless intimacy to the destroyed body, something embarrassing about the obviousness that he would die. He'd wanted privacy. Jamie enclosed a sketch of a row of P-40s in a letter to Marion, their cowlings painted to look like the mouths of roaring tigers.
"I wish I could talk to you about Alaska, though I don't know if you ever had reason to come this far out into the islands, since there was only fog and mud and muskeg out here before. Now there's a harbor and a runway, a tent city. There were some people on Attu and Kiska, missionaries, I think, and people at a weather station, but no one seems to know what happened to them."
He wanted to tell her about everything the war had brought to Adak's empty shores. Endless ships disgorged all the ingredients of civilization. Everything needed to feed and house and entertain 10,000 men. Huts and hangars, but also cold storage buildings and mess halls and dark rooms and torpedo shops, movie theaters and gymnasiums and surgical suites. A menagerie of machines arrived along with everything required to tend them. Mountains of ammunition and ordnance, of tools and spare parts. The essence of war sometimes seemed to be the accumulation and transportation of stuff, of things. He wanted to list these things for Marion, to make her marvel at their number and variety and mundaneness. Consider the journey of a single can opener. But the list could never be long enough to make his point. Maybe that was where the scale of the war lay, in the bits and pieces. He made a watercolor of ships in the harbor and sent it to Sarah without a note. In April, bombardment against the Japanese increased. Invasion seemed imminent. The assumption was Kiska would be first because it was closer. Out by the runway, Jamie ran into the executive officer and told him he'd like to go along when the invasion happened.
"You want to paint the invasion?"
the man repeated, puzzled.
"I'm supposed to paint more than supply lines and air support. The landing force is coming from somewhere else. They won't stop here, so there is no way to get you in with them. It'll be a quick operation. Maybe I could go with one of the bombers."
Fog was advancing over the water, and the XO jabbed a thumb at it.
"You wouldn't see much thanks to this shit. Are you sure you don't want to go back to Kodiak? Get on your way somewhere else?"
Jamie watched the fog drift and creep toward the shore. It was a neutral party to the war, but powerful. It shrouded and delayed, swallowed planes.
"Maybe," he said, "soon."
On May 11th, word came. The invasion had begun. Attu was the target, not Kiska. They thought it would take 3 days. Probably only 500 Japanese soldiers were on the island. Days passed. The officers were grim-faced. There were more Japanese soldiers on the island than they'd thought. Multiples more. Conditions were bad. The going slow. After a week, Jamie went up with a bomber crew. But the XO was right. He didn't see anything. They dropped bombs into the gray nothing just to conserve fuel.
"Stupid motherfuckers," the navigator said. And Jamie didn't know who he meant.
the Japanese, or their own commanders, or the bombs themselves. The thought struck him that, up in the air, they were no different from planes that vanished. Only their eventual return to Adak distinguished them. Being aloft meant being lost to everyone but yourself. And he wondered if that appealed to Marion. Or maybe she didn't notice anymore. An armada assembled in Tokyo Bay. Carriers, battleships, destroyers, etc., all bound for the Aleutians to drive the Americans back to the mainland. It never sailed. Might have. Didn't. After 2 weeks, word came that the infantry was closing in on the harbor where the Japanese had retreated. The XO passed Jamie where he was sketching near the harbor, then turned back, boots squelching in the mud. "A ship's stopping in later today before resupplying Attu," he said. "If you still